Music is a universal means of communication. The variety of human expression that could be communicated through music is highly diversified and virtually unlimited. Because of this, music becomes vitally important as a therapy for handicapped children. So wrote Clive Robbins and Paul Nordoff in their book Therapy and Music for Handicapped Children. The American Association for Music Therapy is currently meeting in Philadelphia in a conference that is jointly sponsored by Temple University. This has brought many of this country's leading therapists to Philadelphia to hold workshops. Yesterday on Fresh Air, we spoke with David Yoder and Lou Shoup about art therapy and communications disorders. Today we're going to discuss music therapy with Dr. Clive Robbins, whose work with the late Paul Nordoff created many breakthroughs both for their clients and for the field of music therapy. Nordoff was a composer of abstract music who in mid-career decided to redirect his music energies and talents to work with children who had serious mental or physical disorders. Clive Robbins met him when he was a special educator. They began a collaboration which lasted until Paul Nordoff's death in 1977. They spent a number of years working together in Philadelphia at the daycare unit for psychotic children, which was a part of the University of Pennsylvania. Clive Robbins, along with Carol Robbins, has recently organized the Nordoff Robbins Center in London and have also begun working with deaf children using music therapy. They work at the New York State School for the Deaf in New York and the Heiterheck Hospital in Germany. A little later this afternoon, we're going to discuss their work with deaf children, and Carol Robbins will be joining us for that part of the conversation. Robbins and Nordoff co-authored a book about music therapy called Therapy and Music for Handicapped Children. In the introduction, Benjamin Britten wrote this. He wrote, "I am not qualified to comment on the importance of psychological cures that these two men have achieved, nor of the extent of their diagnosis. But this I can say, the book is important for musicians, particularly composers. At this curious point in musical history, the validity of communication in art has itself been called into question, and it is wonderful to have a book where the concentration is entirely just on this, on communication, pure and simple." Clive Robbins has brought with him today recordings of some music therapy sessions, some conducted with Paul Nordoff, and some led with his wife, Carol Robbins, with deaf children. They are powerful tapes and will probably be unlike anything you've heard before. Clive Robbins, I want to welcome you to Philadelphia and to Fresh Air. It's a great pleasure to have you here this afternoon.
Well, for us, it's a great pleasure to be here.
I'd like to ask you how you first became involved with music therapy.
I was a special class teacher in a children's home in England. I had been there for 5 years as a teacher. And I had extremely difficult children, really in some ways heartbreaking children, and children with whom I could not communicate, no matter how deeply I felt, how deeply I cared. It just was not possible to reach the essential individuality in each child. I could condition them, I could train them, I could make life more supportable for them and for people who worked with them, but this, to my mind, was not therapy. This was training. And I wanted to find a way in which one could communicate with the being inside that handicap, release it, and see it develop and come into its own way of living. And I was extremely fortunate when Paul Nordoff came to this children's home and began to work in music with the children. I was asked to work with him, which was a great joy to me because I loved his music. I knew his music. And we made a natural team. And really, from the first day's work onward, I realized that in his music, I'd found the key to communication for which I'd been searching.
Had you ever experienced someone using music in this kind of setting before?
No. I'd seen music of all kinds, recreational music, pastime music, music for plays. I'd seen the children enjoy it. But this was something quite new. This was dynamic and searching. It was another type of music altogether.
What did you become aware of in the interaction between the children and the music when you first started experiencing and working with these sessions?
Well, first of all, on the music side, the music wasn't always in a strict tempo. It was improvised, and it would wait for the children. The music would itself ask a question, and the harmonies that Paul Nordoff used would keep the situation open. It would be a searching. The very harmonies themselves would call for an answer from you. They were not kind of old-fashioned harmonies that tended to slow things down. They were harmonies that lifted and opened. And I noticed the children were more attentive, more receptive. And then when they did respond, perhaps vocally or with a drum, the music was right there with the response, supporting it, carrying it further.
Can you tell us what a session looked like and felt like, you know, in an introductory session, for instance, when a child who was coming in who wasn't used to working in this kind of musical setting, wasn't used to having the option of becoming a participant with music?
Well, you know, the children were all really very different, and there were some children who could not undertake any kind of activity. And they couldn't use a drum, they weren't even inclined to tap the piano keys. Perhaps they were very withdrawn and rather cold in their appearance, cut off. And the child might come into the room and just wander. And Paul would work at creating a mood, and he would try to find the kind of music. I think if one is a composer and at the keyboard and a child is there and your fingers are on the keys, you are responding totally to the child. There are certain techniques and certain principles to bear in mind. You don't overwhelm the child. You usually find one kind of music with a mood, and you feel how it's affecting the child. You see the face change, the breathing changes. Perhaps the child begins to make sounds.
So you could almost say that the subject of the improvisation in this music is the child to whom it's directed, and that they're the inspiration for the music that's played.
Every time. It can only work that way in individual therapy. If the child, for example, was an active, rather outgoing, perhaps scattered child who would want to use a drum or even tap on the piano keys in a very energetic way, Nordoff would meet this music, meet whatever the child did, meet the rhythm of the beating, meet the rhythm of the playing, put music to it, and instantly it became an active communication, but in terms of what the child could do. And then from there, from this meeting, new lines of communication would develop from the interchange between the two.
Perhaps this would be a good time to introduce one of the sessions that we're going to hear, recorded sessions of music therapy that you led with Paul Nordoff.
All right, the session we've got here for you is rather dramatic. And if you didn't know the context of it, you could find it very distressing. It's an autistic, psychotic boy of 5 1/2. He comes into his first session, and he begins to cry. He begins to get upset. He begins to jump up and down and show all signs of distress and rejection of the situation. But bear in mind that this is normal behavior for this child. It's part of his everyday behavior when faced with a situation that's strange to him, or when not able to get something he wants. If he can't have a cookie when he wants it or a drink of juice, this is the kind of behavior we get. This child does not use speech. He has about 10 sounds that might mean something, but he will just echo what you say. He's very active physically. He jumps a lot. And when he's angry, he rolls on the floor, leaps into the air, and screams. And it can be distressing. He's learned he can control adults and situations in doing this. Now, Paul Nordoff's reaction is to look at the child and meet him in the condition in which he is. At first, you'll hear the child coming into the room, and Paul is trying to create a calm mood. We know what the child can be like. At first, the music attempts to set a calm environment. The child makes some sounds. Now, listen carefully. Although he's distressed, his sounds are already in the key of the music. He makes his sounds on tones in the scale Paul Nordoff is using. I try, then, to lead the child to the piano to see if he wants to play it. I show him a drum to see if he wants to play that, but he's not interested. He just wanders around the room, becoming distressed. So this would be a good time to start listening to that. Notice the important thing for us is not to get carried away or affected by his distress. This is how he is. This is his condition. This is his normality. For us, it's abnormal. For him, it's normal. But did you notice that he was fitting his sounds to the ends of the musical phrases? So already we know we have reached in the child a musical perceptiveness and awareness. The fact that he vocalizes in the key of the music is an indication to us that he's already, even perhaps unconsciously, becoming musically engaged in what's going on. Then he began to jump, and you heard immediately Paul Nordoff fit the music rhythmically to the boy's jumping. When you've got an autistic child, you have to take the children's behavior and put music to it, so the child knows he's accepted and you're putting music to him, not expecting him to come into what you think he ought to do.
It sounded almost like Nordoff was treating the child like an improviser within the composition, and like the child was reacting to the music and Nordoff was in turn reacting to the child.
That's exactly it. The child is what he is. He's behaving perfectly naturally, rather spontaneously, and in a way this is an unconsciously creative response on his part, or potentially creative. We don't know what's going to happen. The session continues, and you will hear in the next excerpt Edward begin to get really upset. Now, if you have strong maternal feelings, this can distress you. But try and for once put aside your own emotional response to a child crying. Listen to what he does with those screamings. He screams on the dominant, on the tonic. He slides up to tones in the key. He hits them and slides off them. He fits it more and more into the rhythmic structure of the music. You can hear the drum being beaten there. That's Paul playing the drum with the right hand while he's playing the piano with his left hand. He just wants to add more support to Edward's jumping and screaming. He really is able, when he's distressed, to go into a crying tantrum that will last for hours, and it's obvious after an hour he's forgotten the cause of it. He's just upset and continues to cry. And if you listen to this tape carefully, you'll see that he's trying to get into this state, but the music holds him. He can't do it. And you could hear that in the pauses, he's waiting for more music to come. He's already, in a sense, beginning to enjoy screaming with the music.
And that kind of experiencing that behavior in a different way, I guess, becomes an important part of the session.
Exactly. He's now being met as he is. We're not saying, Edward, I can't stand your crying. Please be sweet and quiet. I'm more comfortable that way. We're saying, Edward, scream. Here's music with it, under it. Scream with it. You know, if you were really angry yourself and you really wanted to yell and scream, go home and put on some really marvelous music. Scream to it. Or conversely, if you were very, very sad, you would find nobly sad music more consoling than light, gay music. Music that would really ennoble your own feeling and give it a universality. So we're saying to Edward, fine, be angry, be violent. We'll meet you with it.
Does the session continue?
It continues more, but I haven't more on the tape. What does happen, it would continue in the same way about another 4 minutes. And then I bring him to the piano, and I take his hands and I play very rhythmically in the treble with them, and Paul puts some syncopated music to this, and his crying diminishes, and he wouldn't stay there if I didn't keep him there, but I'm not being forceful. He's rather interested. Then he leaves, and he goes back to the unit completely calmly. There's no continuation of distress. Well, we were very, of course, excited by that session.
It's a very exciting thing to listen to. It's a really incredible use of music, and I guess I'm kind of speechless in a way about it. It's very different than the soothing kind of thing that you might expect to have happened. I think you were beginning to talk about that, where you'd say screaming is bad, so I'll play something pretty, a lullaby maybe, and that will, you know, lull the person into a quiet peace, and perhaps they'll sit calmly or fall asleep. You'd think, if you didn't know, that might be the goal of the music therapist.
I think if something had happened that really upset the child, supposing someone had hit him, supposing he'd fallen, suppose something had happened externally that really upset him, then you might do this. But if it's an habitual condition, then I think it should be met. Naturally, if the therapist sees that the child is coming apart at the seams and it's too much, then you would change the situation or terminate the session positively if you can.
Could you discuss at all the qualities of music that give it the ability to interact with a child who's considered to be non-communicative?
Well, in every short musical phrase, a musical idea, ta-ta-ta-ta, or whatever it is, there is the beginning of an idea there. There is a kind of a code. It can be a melodic code, a rhythmic code. And as this develops, so this idea is developed, and the child can relate the developments to the original. Like in all songs, one phrase is answered by another, and the way a phrase develops and is answered and is repeated and is extended make up for us the meaning of a song. This is the way we interpret music, find it meaningful. There is something in us that responds inherently to the forms of music. Music is made by man, and we hear so much of it now, we are educated by music from a very early age. So for us, it's a whole area of meaningful auditory experience.
So, in a way, language has to be learned to learn that association between word and object or word and emotion. But one does not need training and, you know, to understand the emotional value behind the music or the physical response that music can cause. Which isn't to say that if you haven't studied music, you won't experience more subtlety and nuance within it.
It's much more pristine and direct. We find that we've come to the conclusion, after all these years of work, that musicality is inherent in the human, quote, condition. That to enjoy music, to really make it part of your life, is part of being human. In fact, we call this entity in our children the music child. And it can be a general gift that belongs to all children, or it can be a specific gift. You get some children obviously have much more of a musical gift than others, but there is a general level of musicality among all children, and if you can reach this in a handicapped child, so that the child really becomes wrapped up in this, communicates through it, really actualizes his personality development within music, then you can speak about a music child. For this child, music is something intensely meaningful in this world, something he can share with others, something in which he can find himself.
In the example of the session that we just heard with Edward,
was
there an ultimate goal there? I mean,
the first goal is to communicate, is to meet the child's mood and to communicate. Now, the next session, when he came, he was perfectly quiet most of the time. One time Paul was singing "Good Morning," and the second time Edward came out with "Ah, ah, ah," exactly the melodic intonation of the phrase and the rhythmic emphasis of the speech pattern. And this to us was an indication that maybe music could possibly be an agency to get Edward to use language. We took him again for a third session, and this time we'd heard him crying all morning before he came. He was having a bad day. And he came into the session, and he began just to make single sounds, and really calling to Paul, to sing back to him, and he did it again and again. And then he began, it sounds at first as if he is crying again, but it's quite different to the first session. You'll find that he's using his crying voice and beginning to sing with it. Now, it's important that you should know that there's no record of this child ever having sung any song with other children, with his parents, no TV commercials, which a great many autistic children specialize in. But listen to the way he uses his crying voice and sings. He begins with Polnareff, he finishes it, he sings his own phrases and develops them.
That's, we're going to hear what happened after the session. That's an incredible thing there. You start to hear him responding to individual notes, almost hitting the notes that Paul Nordoff is playing. Another thing that interested me there is at the end when Nordoff said, good, very good. Yeah. It's kind of direct acknowledgement of what's happening between the two of them.
It's businesslike. There's no sentiment there. It's not saying, good boy, Edward. That's good work. We used to think of music as being work. Of course, it's joy, it's fun, it's, in this case, it's drama. But that's good, you know? It's quite objective message to Edward.
I was trying to be able to put into words some of the qualities of the music that Nordoff is using there. And there's a dissonant quality on the piano, but a very almost nostalgic, yearning quality in his voice. And the two of them together are really very moving and very gripping.
You see, the dissonances keep the stimulation going. They keep the strength. They express something of the tension in the situation. And yet, the continuous, you called it nostalgic, the continuous melodic line of the voice, the sustained tones, have a stability. They stabilize the other. And they also have warmth. There's almost, it's almost really like a primal kind of opera between a creative adult and an autistic psychotic child without language becoming creative within his crying. One gets very deeply involved in those sessions, but you have to keep a certain objectivity. You're so busy working with what the child does.
Shall we continue with the next final part of this session?
Okay, that's actually all I can play you from that session. It's all we have here. And now I can tell you briefly what happens. I'll play a little more of Edward from a later session because you'll see what this built up to. But at this time, Edward had to find a personal relationship to us. And over the next four sessions, he gradually got closer to us. He would come to me. I was the co-therapist in the room to help in whatever way would be most useful. And I would often kneel down. And Edward would come up to me and put his arm around my neck and make rather cooing sounds, very affectionate. He had a kind of a jargon, we call it. It's simulated speech. It's not real speech. But he would use it with real affection. As if he's asking a question in friendly tones. And I would simply say, yes. And Paul would take up this intimate mood and put it into the music. And at one time, Edward very gently climbed onto my knee and sat there. And I felt as if a bird had landed in my hand. I had to be so careful not to shock or endanger his trust in us. And then he suddenly came in on the eighth session, took my hand, took me over to a chair, made me stand there, climbed on the chair, climbed up onto me, and insisted that I would hold him so that his head was about a foot above my head. He was looking over my shoulder, and he was shouting and calling to Paul Nordoff. And every time I put him down, he led me back to this chair. He climbed back up there and was very excited and smiling and laughing. He had a sound that he often used to make, which was E-E-E. And if you took it up and said E-E-E back to him, he would say it again. But very quickly he'd become hyperactive, and he'd collapse on the floor, kicking his heels and laughing in a very uncontrollable way. He'd always sometimes say, "Oh," from a distance. Hello, I guess, or hi. But this, too, was a kind of a stereotype, and you couldn't do anything with it. And he began to make these sounds off my shoulder. But he was so restless that we put him down. I put him down, and after a while I wouldn't let him climb on me again. I felt that this was cutting in between a contact between Paul and Edward. And he began to cry, but this time like a distressed child, much more like an ordinary distressed child. And later we heard the session and realized there were some new vocal developments, so that we decided that in the next session we'd let him climb on me and stay there as long as he liked, get as excitable as he wanted to get, and make all the vocal sounds he wanted to make. And this is now what we want to play you. This is from his ninth session. Notice that there he is speaking the hello tones on the fourth and third tones of the scale. He's not yet singing. He's never sung words, but he's speaking hello on these tones. Now, he goes a little further in the next minute. This is just a couple of minutes afterwards in the same session. Hello. You can hear the change of mood, the music is lyric, and you can hear the gentle quality of his voice. All his little sounds, whether they're exclamations or accidental, are right there in the tonality. He just made a little exclamation that was all along the tones of the tonic chord. It's just musicality in these children is so alive, unspoiled, so spontaneous. That's why you've got to work with improvisation with them.
You can hear the pleasure in his voice. I mean, it sounds like he's cooing along with it, really.
Yeah. Well, in the next little, all these examples now are from the ninth session, I put him down, but he leads me right back to the bench. Listen to his musicality.
He's coming down, he's taking my hand, hello.
He's getting closer to us, he's very happy, and his voice gets more and more song-like. Okay, in the next one, he really now sings. He's singing this hello. Paul has tried for hi. He's tried for good morning. Edward isn't interested. He wants to sing hello. This gives this simple hello. He's going to sing it. You'll hear it on major and minor seconds, major and minor thirds. And as Paul moves the music, so Edward shifts the tones to stay right in with the harmony and the melody. This is rather a beautiful example.
You can hear the music becoming less turbulent as the child becomes more calm and more involved with it.
Yeah. You can't force this response. Such a growth can only come out of the child himself, only out of meeting the child as he is, where he is, and giving him the freedom, the support, and also the challenge to come. And then when he starts to come out, there's the music again, supporting it all the time.
I loved hearing the little spaces that Nordhoff would leave sometimes.
Yeah.
You know, like, okay, you here's a space, your turn, and it's not a compulsory thing. I mean, the child's under no pressure to respond there. But I mean, I just really smiled during one space before, where suddenly there's a space there, and the child did like two syllables, two short little bursts of sound. It was really wonderful.
There is a wonderful thing, really, about being in the situation, and that is there is such a thing as we would call it a clinical instinct. You have a feeling of how to do it as the pianist, and then you have also the intuition of what music to use. But the child at this stage is really guiding you, and the thing is, you don't want to spoil the mood. You want to support it, and the child feels can then maintain his trust in you, in himself, and in music.
What happened to Edward after the sessions that we've heard?
Can I play you a little more?
Yes, please.
Okay, this is still from the same session. And I told you about this vocal game, this E-E-E. Now, for the first time, he makes it into a musical game.
No! Hello, Edward! E-E-E! E-E-E!
You can see we both are trying to bring in ideas for language there. Paul is saying Edward, singing Edward, and I'm singing Uncle Paul to try and put words to this rhythm. But we're trying hard, we mean well. But Edward really wants to enjoy his vocal freedom, his confidence, and the putting together his feeling for teasing and his newly developing musical awareness. A little later, he takes this one stage further and puts in a four-note pattern. Paul does get him to imitate his name to some extent after this. And the last example is from the end of this session, and you'll see a very sensitive response to the way Paul sings goodbye. Notice here the element of a musical surprise. There's a change of mood, and this catches Edward.
Listening to, for those of you just joining us, is an example of a music therapy session, one that was held with a young boy named Edward. We heard composer Paul Nordoff at the piano and singing. Assisting in that session was my guest, Dr. Clive Robbins, music therapist, who's in Philadelphia now, attending the conference of the American Association of Music Therapy, now being held in Philadelphia. He's here to give workshops. It was really... it's just extraordinary following that all the way through.
It's so wonderful when a child reveals himself, because there is no criteria for assessing this. I mean, you can make objective rating scales, and these are essential professionally. But the child is what and who he is, and the content of his joy, of his pleasure, of his relationship with the therapist really is so therapeutic at this point, and it's so intrinsically him.
What happens from here? I mean,
well, we had another session, and it was very similar. The vocal responses went further, and Paul at last was able to get some work in speech into the session, and Edward repeated the word nose and finger. Then we played these tapes, naturally, for a clinic meeting on Edward. And they had been trying to give Edward some speech training, but it had been very difficult. But with this evidence now of his sensitivity, it was felt that no matter how difficult he might continue to be, they would continue working. So they began really rather an intensive all-round speech development program wherever he was, whether he was with his daycare worker or in the group or having lying on his cot after lunch or whatever. They would bring speech to him. They'd go through picture books and point out the words. And he began to show an interest in it. And he began, for example, he'd turn back the pages of a Sears catalog and point, and his daycare worker would say, "Stairs," and he might or might not imitate it. For us, everything stopped. And this is a difficult thing for a music therapy to recognize, that in a sense, you've done your job, and you should be now more supportive rather than intrusive. The child can't take more stimulation because he has no defenses where music is concerned. And he needs to have a little time out to equalize his development. And in fact, we did measurements on this, all his responses, very careful records were kept, that 4 months after this session, he had spoken 47 words.
Wow.
And that 22 of them were spoken spontaneously. Once his gorgeous daycare worker came in with a new red hat, and he looked up and he said, "Hat!" Very excited about it. And then 7 months later, he'd used 120 words, including some short phrases, and two-thirds of these were communicative and spontaneous.
So this was really a very, very much a breakthrough session for him.
Yes, but there again, we weren't working in a vacuum. Mm-hmm. And we were working in a very good, protective, supportive unit. I don't think it would have happened had it just been music therapy alone. But I think the combination of the two was very fruitful in Edward's case.
You've brought with you some recordings of another young girl who you worked with. Perhaps we can listen to some of that.
Yeah. Both these recordings are really taken from our book, Creative Music Therapy, which is an instructional book for people who want to work in this improvisational way. So the tapes are selected to be instructive and illustrative of the sensitivity in children. I would like to make the point that not all your sessions are so colorful, and there's a lot of hard work in which you don't know where you're going. You record the sessions, you study them, you keep a full log of what you're doing. And then you begin to detect a certain line of development is taking place. But I just wanted to tell you that not all the sessions mm-hmm. are so glamorous, as it were.
Yeah.
Well, what we have to play for you is, just by way of contrast, is the first session of work with a 12-year-old girl who is cerebral palsied and blind. She's also mentally retarded. She also has a speech defect. She's not using her right hand at the time we begin. There's a drum to her left. We have spoken to her when she came into the room, and we've had no response. We're new to her. We've been asked to take her for therapy because she's kind of settled into a plateau now. She's not progressing. She's not autistic, but the fact, think of it, you're blind, you can't understand much of what's said to you, your speech is limited, you can't move independently. This imposes a kind of a isolation upon you. And again, we're working with music to find out what sensitivity she's got. We've no idea what she's going to do, so, Terry, you and your listeners are in the same position that we are in when this tape is made. We've no idea what's going to happen next. So listen to it from that point of view. She's tapping the drum with her left hand.
Good morning.
It's interesting. She then says good morning once we get into the musical context of the situation. She says it very musically. Good morning. A lot of music in that voice. And when Polnareff plays and sings this back to her, she responds instantly in the tempo to it. We get two very clear responses, then she throws the stick on the floor. You heard it rattle as it fell. And this, to us, signals that she's not sure of herself. She doesn't know whether she can trust the situation. And to throw the stick down is to cut out the communication. So I say to her, who's going to pick that stick up? We want to see if she can find it. We don't know what her abilities are. But in the end, I pick it up. And Paul continues the session by singing. She says, I at school.
I at school.
I school. I school.
I school.
I school. Good morning to Rolanda.
Then she begins this lovely lift of her voice. She's a child who doesn't sing much in the classroom. She has this speech defect. You notice the slow tempo of everything. The drum beating is in this tempo. It's about 80 beats per minute. Her voice is in the same tempo. This is the slow tempo in which she functions. So Paul naturally takes her tempo. He's not pushing her. Is supporting her and inviting more response. And she is waiting for him to play. She sings back. He sings. She waits. She sings. She is really very civilized in the way that she responds. And so attentive.
It's amazing to hear Paul Nordhoff completely picking up on what she's done with the drum. Mm. I mean, he's changed his tempo, changed the general feeling of it. And she keeps coming back to things as if it's almost as if it's scored, you know, and there's certain themes that are like the motifs through it all.
The whole thing is improvisational. But Paul had this wonderful ability that within a few minutes children trusted him. From the way he played, really it is selfless and creative, supportive, stimulating. He had this tremendous gift. All the pianistic resources you could want were totally there at the service of the children. And in this, in a way, you almost create a river or an environment through the music in which the child becomes a being that can express itself and be met. It's a kind of a celebration of the individuality in music, just at the moment. It really is an art of therapy, this way of working.
Shall we return to the session?
Yeah, let's return to the session. She has become very quiet. She's sitting back in her chair, her head down. So Paul wants to create a mood for her.
Hello, 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 hello,
was very typical, a beautiful mood, a support, and then the feeling it's time to get back to work. So that rather gentle improvisation, those two dissonant shocks, and on the second one she picks up the beater and gets back to work. Well, I think we've time to hear what happens at the end of the session, because she's not sure of us. She sings along and beats the cymbal and the drum a little, and then there comes a time where she says, going to go. She wants to get back to her regular routine. And, of course, this becomes a song. And you'll hear them, actually all three of us are joining in and improvising together.
Going to
We've heard a session with a young girl named Anna who had cerebral palsy. She was blind, had a speech defect. We heard her in a music therapy session that was led by the late composer Paul Nordoff and my guest Dr. Clive Robbins. What happened to Anna following the sessions that we heard?
Well, she wanted to sing freely, and she did that. She also became very interested in beating a drum. So she worked with her left hand first and found a steady basic beat. Again, it was in her slow tempo. Later, she began to use the right hand. For some reason, she liked to use this on a cymbal. So with the drum in one hand and a cymbal on the other, she then found a basic beat with the right hand on a cymbal. Then she surprised us by putting them together in alternate beating. She coordinated her hands for the first time. Then she began to want to sing songs more and more, with more freedom. She began to want to coordinate her singing with her beating. Now you imagine this child who cannot walk except with help and in an arrhythmical way, being able with big movements of left and right arms alternately to take a good beat in the music and sing to this, so that in a sense she was having the experience of walking through the beat of music that she could not have in space. Well, of course, she had it in space too, with the big movements of her arms. She then began to play games of repartee, really contradicting Paul Nordoff in the music, and with so much humor and wit, one questioned the retardation element in the child. The parents noticed an improvement in the child. She didn't just want to sit passively anymore, and if they didn't understand her, she insisted upon being understood. This girl, again, to get back to this phrase, actualized herself in music. She brought out her thinking, her control, her speech, the use of her limbs, and put them all together. She became a bigger, stronger personality, and she began to use this in her speech classes, in her special education work. And we saw, after 7 months, such an all-round improvement in this child's growth. And this is one of the roles of music therapy for us, is to enable the individual to become free of the handicap, find himself, and find more effective, satisfying ways then of being himself, despite the handicaps.
My guest is Clive Robbins. He is a music therapist and is in Philadelphia to hold workshops for a music therapy conference that is being jointly organized by Temple University and the American Association for Music Therapy. It's being held at the Warwick Hotel now in Philadelphia. We've had the great opportunity of listening to a few sessions that Clive Robbins has held with the late composer Paul Nordoff. I'd like to introduce now Carol Robbins, who is also a music therapist, who is now currently working with Clive Robbins with deaf children. And we're going to, in a few minutes, hear a sample of what one of the music therapy sessions has been like with the deaf. Carol Robbins and Clive Robbins, I should mention, are also married. Okay. Carol, how did you get involved with working with the deaf?
Well, I had been working in music therapy with multiply handicapped children in New Hampshire. And in this school, the Crotchet Mountain Foundation, there was also a school for the deaf. When I had been there for a period of time, another woman came to assist me in the work, and she was hired as the music teacher for the deaf children. But because we wanted to work together and become a team, we were both involved with all types of children then.
It sounds, I know when I mentioned to people that we were going to be talking about the use of music with the deaf, people looked at me kind of screwy and figured that they must have heard me wrong. And if they just stick around another minute, I'll explain what I really meant, because I couldn't have really meant that. So maybe you could clarify for us a little bit how this kind of interaction can take place.
Well, we have often had this same reaction, and we immediately have to begin to explain that deaf children do not experience music solely through vibration. This is a very big part of it, of course, because music, to understand music, to work with music, for a deaf child is to work directly in the area of his handicap. And most deaf children never have this opportunity. But we do believe that the musicality that Clive mentioned earlier with the other children is inherent in all children. And if they happen to have a hearing loss, this does not mean that the musicality itself is also handicapped.
How are they reached with the music, though? Is it a vibration within their body that they feel from the resonance of the music?
They can feel vibrations in different parts of their body, of course. We all do that, but we're not conscious of it, as they are. But very few children are totally deaf. A very small percentage of the total deaf population has absolutely no hearing. If they have a good means of amplification, a good hearing aid, these children have a lot of music that can be brought to them.
It would be interesting here, I think, to hear an example of a music therapy session with the deaf. Perhaps you could, we'll be hearing a session that you've both led together. Perhaps you can set the scene for us.
All right. Well, our work in New York State School for the Deaf has been rather empirical. It has been very experimental. But we have worked with children from the ages of 3 through 16, all of whom have had amplification. It is very often useless, of course, to work with a child who has no amplification, because a profoundly deaf child then is really totally deaf. So we work with the children amplified. And we have used virtually every aspect of music that you would find in a normal public education. Singing, instrumental works, dancing, movement, and so forth. The example that we would like to play for you, though, is not from a child in New York State, but from a child in Germany. We have just come back from teaching on a music therapy course in Herdecke, Germany, for 6 weeks. And in this hospital, we were fortunate enough to have a young 11-year-old deaf child brought to us by one of the doctors in the hospital. And he said, we would like you to work with this child. So we took him for his first experimental session. We are trying to find out what the child can do. We have no records on him. We do not know what his hearing loss is. We do not know what his educational background is. We know virtually nothing. So Andreas is brought into the room. There are a variety of instruments there. We have a xylophone in front of him. There are also drums, but we begin by singing Hello. Now, Andreas quickly shows us that he has a lot of musicality. He's very quick to respond. He's a very warm, friendly child. He wants very much to do the right thing for adults. He wants to please. And he leads us into singing his name. He is responding on the xylophone as he speaks, which gives us the indication that perhaps he has had some speech training with a xylophone. He moves very freely around the xylophone, not just going up and then going back down again. So why don't we listen to the very beginning?
He has a limited range in his voice. He's not singing in the tonality in which Carol sings. We found out later that he is profoundly deaf. And he's not confident in using his language, but in the musical setting, he's got a lot of confidence. And now you'll hear Carol working with him and taking his tones and, I think, transposing to meet them.
At this point, we're trying to find out how much of a vocal range Andreas has. His impulsive responses have only given us a few notes, but we want to see if he understands the difference between higher pitches and lower pitches. And what you've just heard with my singing was accompanied by gestures to indicate higher tones. Now, he understood the emphasis, but he did not understand how to raise his own voice. So instead, we took his major tone, which was an E, and turned this into a musical waltz.
Hello, 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 Andreas, Andreas, Mola.
He's responding to the drama of the situation. We know now that the child is very rhythmically responsive, but he has a very limited vocal range. In his next session, we now begin to have goals. We want to begin to extend this, and we're going to try to extend his range by using what we call vocal slides. Now, the first slide that I do is really rather dramatic and overextended. And I have my hand on my chest, and then put Andreas's hand on my chest. As I go up the scale, the vibration that he felt in my chest disappears. He then does this to himself, and we move the vibration sense into his head. He's an intelligent child, and he begins to understand.
You hear him now getting the idea of raising his voice. You can listen carefully behind Carol and you'll find he's going up too.
That's right.
Yeah.
Okay, I get exuberant here and I join in using my falsetto. And as you can hear, it's too loud for the microphone there. But the important thing is it's free, he's enjoying it, and he's pitching his voice high. It's just kind of wild at the moment.
This is another type of exercise that he was just doing, which is holding a tone as long as you can. And Clive is making motions all the way up his arm and around his back and down his other arm to indicate the length of the sound.
The important thing is that we find out now is that Andreas has a low pitch and he has a high pitch, and in between them there's a hole. And our work is now to try and slide him across this gap to fill in, as it were, the missing tones. Then when we've done that, then he can really enjoy the pleasure of singing. And I should remind you that although he's deaf, he is not totally deaf. He's profoundly deaf. With a hearing aid on, we have tested him out earlier in the session. He can hear everything Carol does with her voice, and therefore he can hear his own voice. Therefore, he stands to discover the joy of singing, which can play over then into his speech development. Yes, he topped me then. He went much higher than I did. But listen now to how gently he uses his voice.
We've heard a session led by my guests Carol Robbins and Clive Robbins, with Andreas, who is a deaf boy that they were working with in a hospital in Germany. And we begin now to understand the ways that music can be used in a therapeutic setting with someone who is deaf. Carol, have you done performance at all?
You mean professional performance?
Professional performance?
No.
I'm wondering musically if you feel the kind of exhilaration in a setting like the one we've just heard that I would expect one would experience, you know, when performing on a large stage in front of hundreds or perhaps thousands of people, you know.
I have performed, but it was only in the line of duty, so to speak. And I have never had an experience from that would equal the type of experience one has with Andrea sitting next to you. He is so spontaneous. And what you cannot experience with only a tape is the look in this child's eyes. Because he's beginning to discover a part of his own body that he has never used before.
The music that we've heard through the past hour and a half here on Fresh Air is very unlike Mary Had a Little Lamb, or Humpty Dumpty Sat on the Wall. I mean, we've heard a lot of very dissonant things. We've heard some sounds that, you know, you'd hear at a new music performance.
Mm-hmm.
We've heard very melodic things, we've heard very beautiful things, very turbulent things. Would you generalize any of that into the kinds of music that you think works with children? Because the music that's made for children most of the time is very simple. Very simple harmonies, very simple melodies, and very different from what we've heard being so effective this afternoon.
You know, Paul Nordoff used to say, the world of pathology is immense, and the world of music can meet it all the way through. In other words, the dynamics of the human situation where you're in therapy, you're leading a child out of a pathological condition into discovering himself, being himself, that's the important thing. Finding his own capacities, enjoying them, making them. Then the music that's going to support this has got to have life. It's got to have human drama, human warmth, human support, human compassion. To me, it is a very great world of musical art that is used so intimately and directly with children in their growth processes.
No, it's not really, though, the kind of music that we use for children who don't have disorders, for children who don't have profound problems. Do you think that we should start thinking more seriously about, you know, using that kind of powerful music in settings for more typical children?
Yes, well, Paul Nordoff and I wrote many, many works that were actually written directly in work with handicapped children, retarded children or speech handicapped children. And these works are published, and they are used with, quote, normal children. So that this is one way in which our work is spilling over into the realm of normal music education. But I think there is a growing awareness among music educators that we've got to have more dynamic music to meet the conditions of childhood. That what we're giving them really are conventions that are culturally and historically and even academically determined, but there's a much richer creative world that has to be tapped.
I think that what you're saying would also hold true for adults, too, that that kind of powerful and diverse and, you know, kind of music is... I think of the people who shy away from the avant-garde, for instance, some of which we've heard moments of, really, yeah. In what we've been listening to. I can't thank you enough for both being here this afternoon. It's been an incredibly interesting afternoon. Thanks so much for sharing your experiences and the sessions that you've led with us.
Thank you for your interest.
Thank you.
I've been with Carol Robbins and Clive Robbins, both music therapists, both in Philadelphia today to hold workshops at a music therapy conference that is now underway at the Warwick Hotel, where it is co-sponsored by the American Association for Music Therapy and Temple University. Carol Robbins, we just heard an example of the work she's doing with Clive Robbins, is a music therapist who works now with the deaf. Clive Robbins has also worked with Paul Nordoff, the late composer whose sessions we heard a little earlier today. There are books that they have written together that are still in print and available. One of them is called Therapy in Music for Handicapped Children by Paul Nordoff and Clive Robbins, published by St. Martin's Press. The other is a book called Creative Music Therapy, also by Nordoff and Robbins, and that's published by John Day. And I believe that there are cassettes that accompany the text, the same.
You heard some of those cassettes earlier in the sessions of Edward and Anna.
Okay, thank you both again so much for being here today.